This is the Luke Thomas Show podcast. You can listen to the full show weekdays from 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern on Sirius XM Fight Nation Channel 156.
Today on the Luke Thomas Show podcast, we're going to lean into the UFC bantamweight title fight at UFC 251 and talk about what Jose Aldo and Peter Yan have to do to secure a victory. John Anik will join us all the Fight Island to give us a preview of Saturday, as well as what the lay of the land looks like over in Abu Dhabi. And of course, we will dig into the mailbag as we do every Wednesday here on the Luke Thomas Show. This program airs weekdays at 1 p.m. East Coast time right here on Sirius XM Fight Nation Channel 156. And don't forget about that mailbag, LukeThomasShow@gmail.com. Happy Wednesday to you. Happy mailbag day to you. July 8th. I can't tell if the year is crawling by or flying by. I can never decide. Some days it's like, wow, I can't believe it's July 8th. And other days I'm like, Jesus, it's only July 8th. Bit of a mixed bag in that regard. But nevertheless, here we are. All right. Number to call, 877-FIGHT93, 877-344-4893. Just for the folks who are listening here on the show, behind the scenes, I can hear myself, which is a little weird. I don't know what happened. It wasn't that way just like 5 seconds ago, but now I can't. Ah, there we go. Now it's gone. Okay. I think we're in better shape now. All right. So let's start this off. Three title fights at UFC 251. Main event, of course, Jorge Masvidal, Kamaru Usman. We'll talk about that in detail on Friday for a main event preview. Tomorrow, we will talk about the co-main event, the featherweight strap up for grabs between champion Volkanovski and then Max Holloway. Right now, let's focus our attention somewhere else. The vacant bantamweight title. Now, I wish we had a Henry Cejudo fight because, candidly, I do believe he's one of the most talented fighters that we've seen in some time, a generationally gifted fighter. But he abandoned the title. He walked away. It is no longer his. So now it is a vacant bantamweight strap between Jose Aldo, arguably your greatest featherweight of all time, and Peter Yan. All right. So what can we say about this before I get into the numbers? I watched a lot of tape last night. You know, it's so funny. It's in some ways you watch the tape and you're like, man, Peter Yan has just got this, you know, all he has to do is just not mess this up and this is his for the taking. And then there are other pieces of tape you look at and you're like, oof, you know, Jose Aldo might actually get this done. He might actually make this work. He might actually find a way to get another belt. Wouldn't that be incredible? I mean, he didn't deserve the opportunity, but, you know, doesn't mean he can't win. Crazy. Crazy. So why would I say something like that? Well, it's interesting, right? I think the two most important fights when I examine Peter Yan, this is debatable because you see something in all of them. But at 27 years of age, this far into his career, I'm going to say that the fights where I thought the most relevant work was done was John Dodson and Jimmy Rivera. Both of those were in 2019. He had a third fight in 2019, Peter Yan did, against Uriah Faber. And he knocked him out inside of the first minute of the third round. But I don't see that as especially relevant because I just think Faber's a little bit past it and Rivera and Dodson in different ways are not. Now, the Rivera and Dodson fights were only three rounds. And Rivera had a better third round than he did a second, although by the third round, Peter Yan was in clear control of John Dodson. But why do I bring up these two? Well, first of all, they're still ranked talents. And in the case of Jimmy Rivera, top five, top 10 talent at worst. Okay, so that's the most relevant in terms of who's at the top of that division. So that's there. Secondly, what you got out of both guys are probably what you're going to get out of Aldo, although one is not entirely certain, which is counterfighting, right? And two, this is going to be interesting because Aldo did not do this against Marlon Moraes. In fact, against Marlon Moraes, he did the exact opposite, but he has shown a propensity to do this, which is, namely, backing up. In both cases, with Dodson and Rivera, when they exchanged with Yan in the center, they did better. Now, Yan still had the upper hand over Dodson no matter what, but it got pretty tight with Rivera when they were in the center of the cage. So I don't really know what to make of that with Aldo there, but I can tell you this. in the Dotson and Rivera fights, and it went in that order for Jan in terms of his competitive growth. When he had him backed up against the fence line, he is a nightmare. He is a complete nightmare. He does good work behind the jab either way. And let me tell you something. Here is what I noticed about him. And this is going to be important fighting someone like Aldo. You got to be careful in the way that Max Holloway was, right? You got to measure, measure, pop, measure, 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 pop. But you can't ever get too crazy. That might be a bit of an Achilles heel a little bit with Peter Yan, to be quite candid with you. But there is one thing that the tape shows with this guy that is just absolutely unmistakable. Not only is he, you know, switching stance and changing things up and getting creative, dude, he is absolutely unafraid to exchange in the pocket. This guy is not afraid of contact. And I know that sounds kind of weird. It's like, yeah, of course, he's not afraid of contact. He's an MMA fighter. Right. But that's not as universal as you might imagine. There are plenty of fighters, including plenty of strikers, who really base a style around defense, around, you know, very minimally accepting contact. Peter Yan has really good defense, right? He keeps his hands up right around his cheekbones. His eyes see right over the top. You know, and he does a little bit of hand fighting with the lead hand, depending on what stance he's in. But he's got pretty good defense. And in fact, when he overcommits on a big punch and someone tries to get behind him or take him down, he's got exceptional takedown defense. So I don't think Jose would really go in that direction. But to the extent that it's necessary, he's a very, very good scrambler. You didn't see that a whole lot necessarily in the Rivera fight. You saw it a lot in the Dotson fight. And let me tell you something, if you can out-scramble or just match the scrambling of John Dotson, there's just not going to be a lot that I think Aldo can do in that regard, that particular regard. Now, if there's one downside to the contact that Jan is unafraid of, here is one major problem that he has. He likes to back people up, that's good. Likes to work behind, yeah, that's good. Likes to get creative, that's good. Likes to mix it up to the body, that's good. Is quick, that's good. Varies the attack, so it could be an overhand, could be an uppercut behind the jab, could be a knee, right? All that's good. The problem is he is aggressive early, and in the Rivera fight, what you really notice is he missed a lot and overcommitted a lot, and it allowed Rivera to constantly go back to the center or just dodge or just get out of the way. And for an athlete who is still quick, like Jose Aldo is, that is going to be something to watch. It doesn't necessarily mean that Jan will get clipped, because it really, if Aldo is being evasive, you can move in a way where you can get out of the way and still put yourself in a position to counterstrike, or you can just get out of the way because someone is overcommitting. Aldo tends to do more of the latter than the former. But it would allow Aldo to reclaim center. It would force extra workload on Jan. Again, it is possible someone could counter it. So this is really going to be, to me, you kind of know what you're going to get with Jan, in the sense that you know he's going to march forward. You know he's going to stick behind the jab. He's going to force you to make lateral decisions. And when you make lateral decisions, then he begins to make reads. And when he makes the reads, he might switch stance on you to intercept you. He's going to work behind the jab and then fire something heavy behind it, whether it is an uppercut, whether it is an overhand, whether it is a kick, right? You kind of know that's what he's going to get. You don't know what particular weapon he'll throw in every single scenario, but that's sort of the march you down style that he's looking for. That is what you are looking for out of Peter Yan. Here is the funny part about Aldo, man. The guy got famous and won titles and defended titles a lot of different ways. Lights out takedown defense, incredible athleticism. To me, Jose Aldo has some of the best slipping of punches in the entire UFC. I mean, he's so good at it, slipping punches. The thing that really made him famous was his leg kicking, which he hasn't really done a whole lot of in a long time. And yet, if you watch Peter Yan versus Jimmy Rivera, what did Jimmy Rivera have consistent success with from rounds one to rounds three, the entirety of the fight? And the answer is leg kicking. Inside leg kicking, outside. Because Jan is the kind of guy who wants to put you like the frog in the pot, right? You put the frog in the pot, so the allegory goes, turn on the water, it's hot. At first, the frog doesn't feel it and doesn't really make the move. Then the water gets a little bit hotter, and he's like, well, I mean, where's it all really headed? But by the time it's boiling, it's too late. He can't get out now. Right? That's sort of what Jan does to you. He overcommits, switches stances, doesn't land anything too great, and then he just sort of builds and builds and builds, and you've accommodated him till now he's figured out his range and his rhythm. Jimmy Rivera was able to disrupt that rhythm and force these resets from Peter Jan a lot, a whole lot. And he was slamming that thing home. And I'm like, man, I don't know why Jose Aldo doesn't throw him the way he used to. Choice, maybe. Something's wrong with his hips. I don't know. I don't know. Just found out he liked to box more. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. But I have to tell you, if Jan is overcommitting on his strikes and Aldo is committed to throwing leg kicks as a rhythm disruptor, just as a way to land pain. Remember, the best work that Jan does is from his punches, although he can throw different kinds of interesting wheel and spinning back kicks and things like that. But if you take away that base, he's not going to have the ability to march you down. He's not going to have the ability to lean on his punches the way he needs to. Like, it would be incredibly successful and disruptive against him. I have to tell you, if you see Aldo throwing leg kicks early and often, which is not something he has done in a long time, this is going to be a real hard fight for Peter Jan. If Aldo is committed to boxing, it is still a fight that Aldo can win. But if he doesn't incorporate leg kicks in some kind of obvious and clear and important pivotal way, it's a much easier fight for Jan to win. I want to get into Jose Aldo a little bit and sort of see where he is at this point. Like, where is this guy right now, right? So how far back do you want to go? The Conor McGregor fight, sort of a bit of a turning point. Because before the Conor McGregor fight, Jose Aldo was 25-1. He was 25-1 when he went into the Conor McGregor fight. Today, he arrives at 28-6. He's just never been the same since. Now, do you want to say that that was the revelation of somebody who was in decline? Do you want to say that Conor changed him and then forced a decline? You know, it's really going to depend. Your narrative on that is going to depend on your view of Aldo and McGregor. And I'm not here to litigate it, but suffice to say, since December 12th, 2015, he has not had the same success that he did from December 11th, 2015 on back. Right? I think he had won. I mean, listen to this run he was on before the Conor McGregor fight. Tiago Meller, Fabio Melo, Shoji Maruyama, Alexandre Franca Nogueira. That was a guy who was known as Pequeño Nogueira, who had one of the best guillotine chokes in the game. Jonathan Brookins, Rolando Perez, Chris Mickle, Cub Swanson, Mike Brown, Uriah Faver, Manvel Gamburian, Mark Hominick, Kenny Florian, Chad Mendez, Frankie Edgar, Korean Zombie, Ricardo Lamas, and then Chad Mendez again. That was a nice run, folks. One of the best featherweight runs you're ever going to see. But then everything kind of switched. He lost to Conor McGregor. No one ever talks about this. He had a phenomenal rebound performance against Frankie Edgar at UFC 200. Really strong. But the reason no one remembers that is because he had back-to-back stoppage losses at roughly the same time against Max Holloway. The first time at 4:13 in the third round, the second time at 4:51 in the third round. He had two incredible rebound performances, one against Jeremy Stephens. Bit of an early stoppage in my mind, but he was in the driver's seat at the end there, I'll put it that way, but although Jeremy Stephens was landing on him. And then phenomenal win over Renato Moicano. Also a bit of a somewhat early stoppage, but, you know, nothing too controversial. You can give him those. So that's fine. Okay, and now Moicano, by the way, has left the weight class. But then he followed up with a fight against Volkanovski. Folks don't remember this, but Volkanovski didn't drop a round. Just completely outclassed him, okay? And then he fought Marlon Moraes, and this was the split decision loss at bantamweight. Now, you can make a case that Jose won that. He certainly, a bare minimum that you can say for him in that is that he outperformed expectations. I think that's very fair to say. I thought Marlon was going to house him, and he didn't. He did early, and then the tide completely turned. So keep that in mind. Okay. And that brings us to this position now. What can we say about Aldo's game at this point? to me, I think I'm going to make the case that it's regressed. It's not merely that it's changed, but that it has regressed. And there are some hallmarks of things that have haunted him a little bit. I'm going to say that his hands are better than they used to be. He puts better combinations together. He's always done pretty consistently good body work. But to me, the absence of the leg kicks is just a dramatic, not merely change, but decline. I don't know how you can make an argument that he is a better striker now than he was before, not merely in terms of what he's able to do in terms of wins and losses, but just like what kind of punishment he's able to exact. I think that these two are going to find themselves in the clinch a lot. And oftentimes what Peter Yan finds is someone trying to take him down. Jose is not going to do that. Pay attention. If Jose doesn't go to the leg kicks, which is just, would be very silly if you ask me, pay attention to who wins in the clinch, who initiates the clinch break, who gets adaptive there. These two are going to find themselves there because Peter Yan is going to march forward. I don't know how much success he's going to have, but I know he's going to try it. If they do that, if he marches into him, and you see it all the time with Peter Yan fights, especially early when he overcommits, these guys clinch. But he's used to people trying to take him down. What happens when he has another striker who wants to exchange with him on those terms, who, by the way, has a background in Muay Thai? He's never been a Wanderlei Silva, Ty Plum kind of guy. That's really not who he is. But I wonder, with a speed and a counter-striking instinct, what he might be able to land on the clinch break. Because if Yan doesn't have his hands up on the clinch break, he's going to get chewed up. The clinch and the clinch break are going to be absolutely essential in this fight. Mark my words. Now, how do they match up? Very quickly, let's go through some of the numbers. The average fight time for Yan, 11.5. Aldo, 13.5. They're the same height. Aldo has a 3-inch reach advantage. Keep that in mind. The output for Yan is extraordinary. He lands almost 6 strikes a minute. He absorbs about 3. It's a huge differential. Aldo, a little bit more judicious, but he's also tougher competition. 3.5 strikes landed per minute, 3 and some change for strikes absorbed. They both have about the same striking accuracy and defense. Okay, takedown average, almost 2 per 15 minutes for Peter Yan. So he's not going to be able to have those, I don't think, against Jose Aldo. And if he doesn't, how does that change things? Takedown accuracy, about half. Takedown defense, 87% for Yan, 91% for Jose Aldo. That's about it. So those are how their numbers match up. It's going to be interesting to see the clinch. It's going to be interesting to see what happens when Yan can't get the takedown. It's going to be interesting to see if Aldo goes to the leg kicks. And if he doesn't, when he moves, does he move and strike or move and evade? Really going to be interesting here. When we come back, we're going to be joined right from Fight Island by the voice of the UFC himself, John Anik, will be here. It's the Luke Thomas Show. Don't go anywhere.
This week on World of Basketball, former New Zealand star Kirk Penny joined the show, and he spoke about how lucky he was to play for two great Hall of Fame coaches in Dick Bennett and Bo Ryan.
Honestly, I feel so blessed to have played for both Coach Bennett and Coach Ryan. And the coaches that have great systems, they have a real loyalty to their system. Like, they are not going to change. The player needs to fit into that system. When you find those coaches, even if the players aren't nearly as good as the other team, because they're so disciplined and they eliminate losing, they're going to find ways to beat you.
New episodes of World of Basketball are available every Thursday on the SiriusXM app, Pandora, and Apple Podcasts.
Joining us now via the magic of Zoom is the voice of the UFC. He is already on Fight Island, and he is gracious enough to make some time for us in the middle of his quarantine. It is the one and only John Anik. Hi, John. How are you?
My man, Luke Thomas, it's always good to be with you, and I have all the time you need. I'm like 14 hours into my 48-hour mandatory quarantine here on Fight Island, so I can chop it up with you for as long as you need me today, my man.
All right. Well, let's sort of get a lay of the land here. What in terms of where you guys are and where the arena is, how distinct is that from Yas Island?
So essentially we're in a 10-mile square mile radius right now. I'd imagine the arena is 2 or 3 miles away, but full disclosure, I mean, I got here, I got tested, I quarantined in my room and just started diving into the preparation. So we're kind of taking it day by day, hour by hour, one hurdle at a time. I can't tell you where the arena is, if I'm being honest with you.
Hmm. How was the travel?
It was okay. You know, I flew from Miami to Las Vegas. I quarantined in Las Vegas for 36 hours, passed a COVID test there, and then we all took the charter. UFC President Dana White was on it, as well as a lot of the athletes who are competing on July 15th. Calvin Kattar and Dan Ige were sitting about 15 feet apart, which was kind of interesting for me. But all things considered, it was pretty seamless. We were on a bus for about 2 hours. Once we got to the airport in Abu Dhabi, we waited for the police escort to come back and took our COVID test. They give you a choice of throat or nose, which is kind of nice. I couldn't believe Dana actually chose the nasal swab, but seems like it's all systems go. But I think for a lot of us, until we get through the three or four COVID tests, we're not going to feel like we're working this show until we actually get there.
Yeah. So what is next for you? You have 48 hours total you have to do in the room. As you mentioned, you've knocked out about 14. So when that 48 hours is up, assuming that you are COVID free, what happens then?
So at the end of the 48 hours or towards the tail end, we'll do our fighter meetings over Zoom, which was not the case in Las Vegas. So we'll do our fighter calls on Thursday night local time. And then presumably by Friday at 2 a.m. local time, I will be cleared. And then I can resume normal activities. Probably we'll try to go outside and cut a little bit of weight. And then we'll be hosting UFC Live. So I think for a lot of us, it's just about getting through this 48 hours, kind of maximizing the prep time, and then be ready to hit the ground running.
Yeah, you got to be thrilled with that, right? I mean, 48 hours during fight week of essentially, I mean, maybe you have calls like this or other things you have to do, but that's about as uninterrupted as you're going to get.
You're exactly right. And you know me well, and you know my processes when it comes to the preparation. This is a play-by-play guy's dream. On the road, no matter where I am, what city in America or internationally, most of the time during fight week, I'm essentially quarantined in my room anyway. And now you're making all my analysts and broadcast partners hole up for 48 hours. So this is not much different, candidly, for me than a normal fight week. And I always say, too, if somehow there was a power outage and the card got delayed 5 hours, I could make good use of that time. There's always one more Luke Thomas video you can watch. There's always one more article or one more little nugget out there. So for me, the preparation is really never done. So this, in some ways, is probably a little bit of a blessing in disguise.
Is your venue where the fight's happening, is that going to be air conditioned?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, it will okay. be air conditioned.
And again, you know, the worst show I ever did temperature wise was June 8th, 2013. I'll never forget it. It was Big Nog versus Fabricio Verdum in a main event, literally on the equator in Fortaleza, Brazil. And my dress shirt was completely soaked through before the first prelim. And our late great producer, Bruce Connell, said to me, "You got to put your backup shirt on." It's like, bro, I don't bring a backup dress shirt to the venue. What you see is what you're going to get. So we have been conditioned to a lot of different fight atmospheres. I can tell you as a fellow broadcaster, calling fights over 8 hours when there's no air conditioning is about as challenging an environment as there could possibly be. But yes, it is a climate controlled venue. We are not fighting in the octagon on the beach. You know, that is a bell and a whistle, and I think for the aesthetic, but we will be in a climate controlled arena, and probably no one's more thankful about that than me other than the fighters.
How does this event for you, by the way, John Anik joins us here on the Luke Thomas Show. How does this event for you compared to 249? And here's what I mean. You know, 249 was the first one back post-pandemic. Sort of everyone was like, oh, the eyes of the sports world are on UFC. And now there's other things kicking off in Europe. Soccer is more or less back. I think MLS tournament started here. Some of the folks have already reported to Orlando for the NBA bubble, as I'm sure you're aware. But I have to tell you, with the addition of Jorge Masvidal to this card, no disrespect to Gaethje or Ferguson or any of the folks who competed in Jacksonville, it feels like, no, now the eyes of the world are on UFC, and you add in this sort of fight island allure. Does this one feel not just bigger, but like a little bit more into the magnifying glass of maybe casual observers?
Absolutely. I also feel like we have built up that casual fan base over the last 2 months, and I think that there has been a residual effect from UFC 249. That show delivered to such an extent that I think a lot of people tuned in on May 13th for Anthony Smith and Glover Teixeira, maybe tuned in again on May 16th. So time will tell as to how many of those fans we will retain long term in terms of making them closer to hardcores than casuals. But I think it stands to reason that we're going to do a huge number. I pushed out a tweet and all it said was UFC 251, Usman versus Masvidal. And I think I got more response to that tweet than anything I have pushed out on that website since 2009. So you're absolutely hitting on a salient point there, that the Jorge Masvidal inclusion has really reverberated with a lot of sports fans that aren't just the MMA avids like you and me. And you also parlay that with the fact that it's only the sixth championship triple header in UFC history. I mean, we have had a lot of them recently, twice in 2017, but this is a rare occurrence. And I'm just praying I pass these tests and I'm able to call it, if I'm being honest with you.
Yeah, well, obviously we wish the same. I'm sure you'll be okay. Let's sort of focus in on Jorge if we can here for just a second. You know, your broadcast partner, Michael Bisping, I always think about him when I think about Jorge, not because they once had beef that has now been squashed, not because of that, but because for Michael, UFC 199, last minute notice, comes in, beats Luke Rockhold, is able to fight Dan Henderson again, and he wins that one in a faraway land. I mean to say this, one of these guys who just kept plugging away, said yes to an opportunity, and then the last chapter of his career was easily his best. I don't know exactly how much longer Jorge's got in the game, but he's the most senior fighter in UFC history to get a title shot, this being his 49th contest. In knowing Michael and being there for 199, what is your sense about what it all might mean for Jorge in terms of how it would change his legacy to get a title on Saturday night?
You know, he is a prize fighter. He has mouths to feed. I think money is oftentimes at the forefront of his mind, but he cares deeply about winning the sport's ultimate prize. And I go back to 2009 with him because we both did season one of Bellator. And oftentimes throughout Masvidal's career, even outside the UFC, he's just fallen short in the big one. You know, Bellator season one was groomed to have Eddie Alvarez and Jorge Masvidal meet for the inaugural Bellator lightweight championship. And then, of course, Toby Imada intervened, submitted George Masvidal with an inverted triangle. And that is still the last time that George has been finished, 11 years ago and a couple of months. So Sengoku or Dream, oftentimes he just came up a little bit short when he fought Gilbert Melendez. Obviously, December 2011 was his last major title shot. Competitive, but a clear win for Gilbert Melendez. He wants to be an undisputed champion. The BMF title is nice, but I can assure you that Masvidal cares deeply about his MMA legacy. And you talk about sort of putting a capstone on a movie. If he is able to somehow hand Kamaru Usman his first loss in the UFC and walk away with the undisputed welterweight title, I think it'll be one of the greater stories on that Bisping level for me, no doubt about it.
The other part about this, though, is I kind of feel for Kamaru. I mean, he's the champion. Why would I feel for him? Here's what I mean, John. I wonder how you feel about it. Kamaru doesn't listen. Not everyone is as charismatic as Jorge Masvidal. And to get that win in London where he beat Till, and then, of course, the skirmish with Leon Edwards is unfortunate in the way that it happened. But to then afterwards with the three-piece and the soda, I mean, you couldn't have struck a more interesting tone to get people's attention. You know, Kamaru's just not that guy, at least not that we know of yet. But I think he is profoundly underappreciated in terms of how talented he is and his output. He is a wrestler in the way that we know wrestlers to be in MMA, but kind of like 2.0. Let's say he gets a victory over Jorge. How much does that boost his popularity stock?
Well, I hope he gets a push. And I walked up to Kamaru Usman at the airport and I said, you know, George is getting all the credit for this fight coming together. And I hope you know promotionally, we acknowledge the fact that you're stepping up on short notice too. You know, Kamaru Usman left Vegas and flew to Dallas and then had to go back. So there have certainly been trials and tribulations for him. But you are right. I mean, if there is a more underappreciated champion on this roster, then I haven't found him yet. He can tie George St. Pierre's record, obviously, for consecutive welterweight wins in the UFC. Despite the fact that this is only his second championship title defense, he barely lost a round in his UFC career going into that Colby Covington fight. And I just believe he's criminally underrated from a personality standpoint. I do think there's a lot there too, but for one reason or another, he hasn't resonated with fans the way a Jorge Masvidal has. But I do think it stands to reason, given all the shine on this fight card and all the shine on George Masvidal, that if Kamaru Usman can not just win, but to do so decisively with a finish, I think it stands to reason that he could take his stardom to that requisite next level.
And then we go to the co-main event, which to me, I don't make a case that everyone should think like me. To me, it's the most fascinating one, but just for my personal interest. We talk about being criminally underrated. I will tell you, I think that Volkanovski is the most underrated champion. I've asked people, like, what, you know, tell me how you feel like Volkanovski won. And certainly, you know, the buck does not stop with my analysis. But suffice to say, when I go back and I watch the two fights that really stand out, not so much the Mendez one, but the Aldo one and then obviously the Max one, I don't think people understand exactly how good Volkanovski is. They kind of appreciate what he did, but they don't really. There's another level to how good he is, and I don't think if he doesn't beat Max again, they won't.
Right.
Why haven't people taken him? Is it just because he's like your neighbor mowing the grass kind of vibe to him?
I think there's something to that. You know, he certainly doesn't get the acknowledgement of a fighter who is 21-1 and who has never lost in this weight class. But I think this is the opportunity for him, right? He knew going into that first Holloway fight, as a lot of title challengers do when they're taking on a long reigning champion, that he was going to have to beat Max Holloway twice. Now, I'm not suggesting that he held a lot of things back. But you know Eugene Behrman. I mean, that genius word gets trotted around to guys who don't deserve it. He does. And I do believe that they're going to have a little bit of a different strategy. I think they're going to be a little bit more aggressive. But Max never really made the adjustments. He did late in the fight. I still had it 50-45, if I'm being candid. But I think they have a lot of things that they have in their arsenal that they did not expose in that first meeting because they didn't have to win five rounds fairly decisively. So Volkanovski certainly is as underappreciated as Usman, if not more so. And, you know, all that guy needed was a championship opportunity, or at least that was the way a lot of us felt, to become the champion. And he certainly deserves the respect he's getting from Las Vegas going in. I think Max will be better this time around, but I think he's going to have to be because Volkanovski is going to be even better and even more prepared.
Yeah, and I don't want to take away Max, what he has done. He's been an absolute genius in there as well. I just think he's up against it. Do you buy that he trained over Zoom and didn't see his coaches, or is he saying that because he doesn't want to get in trouble with Hawaiian authorities?
It's a great question. You know, I think we'll have more clarity when we have our fighter meeting with him on Thursday night, and you can be sure that we're going to lead the conversation with that very thought. You know, I think it's a little bit of gamesmanship, I'm sure, and even fighters whose training camps have been compromised. Most of them have found a few able bodies and found a way to maximize things given whatever their regional circumstance is. I mean, what Dan Hooker dealt with in New Zealand, I don't know that any fighter is gonna be dealing with things as strictly as he was. So I think he's blowing a little bit of smoke, but far be it for me to question the veracity of his statements. I think we'll have more clarity on Thursday night, but I expect Max to be, if not at the height of preparation, pretty damn close.
And then that brings us to the last title fight, Jose Aldo versus Petr Yan. Let's start with Aldo. We did a little exercise yesterday on the show, John. We were talking about who, like, if you can find any permutation where anybody wins, who benefits the most? And we didn't come to a consensus, but I feel like you could make an easy case of all the people who could potentially win of the three title fights. Aldo could benefit the most. You know, it's funny. A lot of people want to throw him in to the discussion about greatest of all time, or at least, you know, in that Mount Rushmore kind of conversation. And the thing is, I never really disagree with their logic, but it just doesn't, for some reason, I just can't, it doesn't occur to me to put him there naturally, although I think he's on the bubble. Right. Let's assume he's on the bubble. Let me tell you something. You win a title at bantamweight this late in your career, you're off the bubble at that point. He has a massive opportunity here, right?
Oh, there is no overstating it. And I think you set it up well. And I don't really worry too much about him cutting down to 135 pounds a second time. Certainly doesn't have that 1 pound allowance that he did for the Marlon Moraes fight. He's pretty ornery when he cuts weight, but I think he will get through that hurdle. And stands to reason that he's going to have a lot of championship experience to lean on that Petr Yan won't have. I have just been so blown away by Petr Yan, and I only got to watch him fight live once or twice. But I do believe that that Jose Aldo is the livest of the underdogs in that plus 200 range. And again, I think when you talk about 25 minutes versus 15 minutes, you know, we haven't really seen Petr Yan be extended. So I think a big part of Jose Aldo's strategy coming in is to try to sort of stem the tide early on, get to that magical 7.5 minute mark. And I think if Aldo can get there, you know, maybe the pendulum swings his way. But big picture on his career, I mean, this is the king of Rio de Janeiro. That is a phrase that does not get tossed around lightly. And as someone who's been to Brazil 27 times, they just don't come more revered than Jose Aldo. So he's certainly in my GOAT conversation, whether he wins or not Saturday night.
By the way, I don't know if you know this, in terms of opening odds, now where it ends up, your guess is going to be as good as mine, but in terms of opening odds, this is the most he's ever been an underdog in his professional career, Jose Aldo. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Again, I mean, I think oftentimes too, Vegas loves undefeated records, and I know Petr Yan does have a professional loss that he avenged, but Vegas loves those undefeated records, man, and Yan hasn't really been touched in the UFC, other than maybe the Dodson fight. So we'll see, man. You know, I'm just excited. Three title fights. Hope they all stay together.
All right, last thing on this is Peter Yan. I feel so bad for him in this sense, which is if he wins, you're like, why would you feel bad for him? Well, if he wins, okay, obviously phenomenal achievement. You get the belt. You beat Jose Aldo. You know, the world is your oyster. Or is it? Because if he wins, can you really be like, okay, well, now we're entering the Yan era of bantamweight? I mean, there is just a row of absolute mutants he has to fight. I have no idea. Like, if you wear the belt, John, you're supposed to be the best fighter in that weight class. And maybe he is. But even if he wears it, I absolutely cannot be sure. It's a weird degree of uncertainty.
There is no doubt about it. If you look at the top 10 among the men at 135 pounds in the UFC, it's the deepest top 10. And I say that with all due respect to 45, 55, and 70. But yeah, I mean, when you talk about Aljamain Sterling being next and then just one killer after the next, I think it's going to be hard for anybody at 135 pounds, whether it's Piotr Jan or Jose Aldo or even Aljamain Sterling, to have 5-6 successive title defenses in a row. So yeah, there are, it stands to reason, stiffer challenges that await Piotr Jan. But man, wouldn't it be something if this kid at 27 years old, you know, just scratching the surface of his fighting prime, you know, could beat a legend like Aldo and become the champion. You know, I think it'll be exciting to see what happens, but Aljamain Sterling is waiting in the wings. And as you know, he is a real problem.
Yeah, he's the real deal, Holyfield. All right, before you go, I saw this news right before we went into the interview. Paul Felder, let me back up a step here. Dean Thomas tested positive for COVID-19, so he can't go. Mike Brown, we knew that from yesterday. But I guess Paul Felder was sitting next to Dean Thomas on one of these flights. Who are you broadcasting with? Because I'm guessing Bisping's over there, but Cormier, hello, he has to fight next month. He ain't going. I'm guessing Joe didn't want to go to Abu Dhabi. Who are you calling these fights with, man?
So it was going to be Michael Bisping, Paul Felder, and me, but Paul is quarantined in Las Vegas right now. He did test negative for COVID-19, okay, but he is not able to make it over here for July 11th. Maybe if he gets another test that's negative, then he would be able to come here for the July 18th show. So at least right now, as long as Michael Bisping and I can stay healthy, you're looking at a two-man booth for UFC 251. And that'll be the same way for July 15th for Cater and Ige. But I feel for Paul, man. You know, he did everything that he was supposed to do, including a negative COVID test, but sat next to the wrong guy on the plane. And he is pretty livid right now in a Vegas hotel room.
Well, I can understand. Listen, take care of yourself. I can't wait to hear your call. I don't know what it's like for you when you get home and how long you have to quarantine and everything, but we are so excited for Saturday, and it's an honor to get to talk to you, and it'll be great to hear your call on Saturday as well. So take care of yourself, and I am looking forward to it, good friend.
You know how much I admire your work and your friendship, and I appreciate the good thoughts, man. I'll see you on the other side.
All right, there he is, John Anik. Luke Thomas Show, coming right back.
Baseball is back.
60 games in 66 days. Opening day is July 24th. Forget about labor disputes and prorated pay. Now it's time to lace them up and win some ball games.
They're going crazy!
Hear every bit of breaking news and analysis leading up to the 2020 season on MLB Network Radio, Sirius 209 XM 89, and the Sirius XM app.
Mail time!
News here!
Have a question about MMA, sports, entertainment, or life in general?
If people just came to me for the answers, the world would be a better place.
Email Luke at lukethomasshow@gmail.com and get the answers to all those burning questions during the Luke Thomas Show Midweek Mailbag.
All right. We do it every Wednesday. By the way, I don't want you to forget, because I almost did. All right, we do it every Wednesday, lukethomasshow@gmail.com. Time for the TLTS Midweek Mailbag. Cobb, without further ado, let's get this party started.
Mail, motherfucker!
All right, I figured I'd start with our 251 questions first, and I think this is a good one. This comes from Ricky, who says, "Hey, Luke, does anyone know why Aldo has abandoned his leg kicks? I believe it was at least a major part of his success. It seems to me he never used them anymore, and it coincides with his lack of dominance. What do you think about that, Luke?"
It has to be some kind of an injury. I don't know why you would get away from something you were really good at, especially now when you don't have to kick the thigh anymore and you can just kick the calf, which for folks who may not realize this, you can do it from further away, and which makes it safer. I don't know, dude. I really wondered this too. Like, you were looking at, I was looking at some of Dustin Poirier's kicks from the fight against Dan Hooker, and you can tell he can't quite turn his hip over. And at first I thought it was intentional because I thought he was trying to sneak the shin underneath the elbow that might be covering your ribs, and that could be true. But the other part is, I just don't know if he can turn his hip over anymore. I wonder if Aldo is the same. You know, that's what I mean when I'm like, oh, he's only 33. Yeah, but 33 in dog years. You know, that. So, you know, why you would just give up? I mean, understand that the leg kick was not just something he was, like, good at. It was a dominant feature of his game. And one where he wasn't made to pay for. It wasn't like he was throwing it and landing and then getting chewed up for it. He just kind of stopped. I mean, maybe it's preference. I tend to think it has to be some kind of injury. Is there another part to it?
No, that was it. He just wanted to know why you think he stopped kicking.
Yeah, I think that's probably the end of the... Or maybe he's got some shin issue, hip issue. I don't know, but it's weird. Next.
Answer my question!
All right, this comes from Miguel in Florida, who says, hey, Luke, what's your opinion now about the quote-unquote Fight Island? Was it a hoax or a stroke of genius by UFC and Dana?
Well, did we say it was a hoax?
I don't think we said it was a hoax, but I think we kind of laughed when, like, when Dana talked about how, you know, this wasn't going to live up to what the fans thought it was going to be, and because it couldn't, in order to get everything done and get the production in. So do you think we got a little bamboozled, or at least the public?
I think the public did. I mean, when they're selling, you know, shirts that say location unknown, it's like, oh my God, what is this, the A-team, for fuck's sake? I mean, stop. No, that's a little silly. And, you know, I mean, what are we doing here with that? But what I can say is, you know, we've been talking about the UFC's task to date with Nevada, right? When they're doing the shows at the Apex facility, which is fly someone in on Tuesday, send them out on Saturday or Sunday, and house them in there. And then, you know, the whole process starts over again, and how it's very easy to do. It is pretty clear that doing this in Abu Dhabi is much harder. Now, a lot of this, what they're doing in Fight Island is the closest equivalent operation to what the NBA is trying, right? Where you're just trying to have this bubble where once you get into the bubble, everyone is safe, but they have to be very sure that before you are released into the bubble that you won't get anybody sick. So in that sense, the logistical undertaking and the cost, I certainly think the UFC deserves a bit of a hand in that, right? Because doing Fight Island is not merely important for their business for all the reasons that we know, which is they can't get European fighters and Asian fighters into the country, but they can get them in a mid-range spot, send everyone there. That's the sort of ticket here. In that sense, it's something that they kind of have to do, but the way in which they've done it has been very... I mean, look, Bellator's not been going again. I don't know what they're waiting on. Like, I find it kind of weird we haven't heard anything from Bellator. Now, maybe there's something that's out of their control, that's a Viacom CBS thing. I don't know. But, you know, UFC's been rocking and rolling since May. We're now in July. So it's kind of interesting. Anyway, it's the closest thing the UFC has done to what the NBA is trying to do. Still a pretty far cry from it, but you can tell, you should be able to appreciate how hard the NBA's task is by looking at everything they're doing on Fight Island and realizing they're doing that with significantly fewer people who are there for shorter periods of time. And even that is very, very difficult. So I will give UFC credit for that. I think they really have, I mean, you should see some of these protocols that they've got going on. It's wild. So I think that is deserving of praise. But everything else is just silly. All right, next.
Message!
All right, this comes from Dustin, who says, hey, Luke, what's the likelihood of this weekend's action resembling UFC 245, where were it not for Usman finishing Colby, we were 50 seconds away from all three title fights going the distance? With the implications and already poignant effect the heat is going to have on the event, what concerns would you have being the last fight and subject to how the night goes in these conditions? Love your work. Great show as always. Thanks for taking my question. And P.S., get with John Morgan and ask him about the guy who made him get Venmo just to buy him a beer. Would like to do the same for you and KOB at some point.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not going out to bars anytime soon. I can assure you that. So the question is what here? It's like fighting at night. And are we going to have all three fights go the distance? I'm not sure what the night has to do with it.
Well, yeah, he's asking, one, what do you think the likelihood is that all three fights go the all three title fights go the distance?
High.
And two, what type of effect do you think the heat's going to have on these guys?
Well, if there's one benefit, if there's one benefit to fighting between 2 a.m. and 8 a.m., which is what they'll be doing local time, it's you're probably at the coolest part of the day. Now, okay, so what time is it now, Cobb? It's going to be 10:30 in Abu Dhabi. All right, so let's do current temp in Abu Dhabi. It is 95 degrees with a 64% humidity. Now, if we look at the time, at 2 a.m., it's about 93. At 5 a.m., it's 90. And then 8 a.m., it's back to about 93. So they're literally in the coolest part of the day, and they're going to be in a climate-controlled environment. I really, assuming that the climate control works in the facility that they've built, I don't have any worries about that playing a role. Now, you're asking about it going the distance. Yeah, I think there's a high probability it goes the distance. To me, I think the co-main event is a virtual guarantee for five rounds, and the co-main event, the main event, I would say is a pretty high guarantee it goes five rounds. I'd even say probably for the bantamweight fight, although that one's a little bit harder to figure out. Cobb, what is your sense? You're going to get 15 rounds out of these three fights? I don't think that's crazy. If any of them end early, which ones would you say are the likeliest to end early?
Ooh, I feel like Max and Holloway definitely go the distance again.
No doubt.
Jorge and Usman's interesting.
Here's the thing. If Jorge's having his way, I could see that being finished off.
Yeah.
But if Kamaru's the one attacking Jorge and they're in wrestling positions, it's not. It's going to go the distance. And then with Aldo and Jan, it's like, you know, the two times that Jan fought somebody who was a top-level contender, it went the distance. And Jose's kind of gone the distance a lot in his career as well.
Yeah. You know, I feel like, again, I feel like I'm just sleeping on Aldo here. There's a chance that one could end, but Jose Aldo has been very hard to put down. Only a couple guys have really been able to do it. I think that one probably goes the distance. I think the highest likelihood is either, it's probably Jorge and Usman, I would think.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But if it's just Usman one-way traffic, you know, strap in. It's going to be a while because Jorge's defense is very good. And so as a consequence, it's hard to do things to him, which means nothing really, not nothing happens, but not enough happens to meaningfully move the fight in a direction towards a finish. So, yeah, it's going to be a tough one. Let's do one more here before the break.
Mayo, motherfucker.
All right. Well, speaking of Jorge, this comes from Armando, who says, Hey, Luke, appreciate your candidness on COVID. The show is always great. Concerning the Jorge-Kamaru fight, if Jorge wins, do you think there's any way in hell Gilbert Burns can get the next title shot? Or will they go full tilt with Connor or Nate? I don't see how Nate would even be possible other than the verbal comments made.
Okay, who wrote this question?
Armando.
all right. Here's the point that I've been making for a while now. I don't know, honestly, if... So if Jorge Masvidal wins on Saturday, and he becomes the UFC welterweight title, first of all, you can imagine Kamaru's probably going to want a rematch. I don't think they'll give him one, but, you know, one never knows depending on the circumstance. But this is the thing I've been thinking about. When you examine how big of a deal it would be for Jorge Masvidal to become an undisputed weight class champ in the UFC, this fulfillment of this potential that, you know, after the Larkin fight, you were like, after the Hendo fight, you were like, after even the Stephen Thompson fight, you were like, you knew he was good. You knew he was talented. You just didn't know what it would, if it would ever amount to more than just being that. And if he's able to get it, irrespective of whatever is next, it is such a crowning and monumental achievement, especially for a guy to be the most senior in UFC history in terms of getting the title shot. But here's the deal, and this is where it gets really interesting. It has so much significance for his career, irrespective of any other considerations. But how can you look at this and not have a consideration about Conor McGregor? Conor McGregor is looking for a fight that interests him. Now, I don't know exactly what that might be. I don't know what lies in his heart or his mind. But if I see a weight class that he now competes in, at least, you know, I don't know if it's the best fit for him, but he can do it. You have a guy who would then be champion, who, like him, would used to be a 155er, now a 170er, right? Unlike someone like Kamaru or Tyron, who are not merely wrestling-based, but those guys couldn't make 155 if their lives depended on it. You have a guy who prefers to strike, and you have the ultimate B-side in terms of popularity imaginable. So let me get this straight. You'd have a guy who went from 155 to 170, prefers to strike, could do a lot of heavy lifting in terms of sales, and what would be on the line is the weight class title. So if Conor wins, he'd be the first person to win a title in three different weight classes. And while the BMF title would not be up for grabs, Conor would say that he now should have it, right? So you'd throw that in the mix as either trash talk or some other consideration or just sort of part of the experience. How does Conor say no to that? Dude, you're never going to get an opportunity to fight at welterweight for Conor that's better than that. And that's not me saying that I think Conor wins that fight. That's not me saying I think Conor deserves to be the favorite there. That's not me saying any of that. That's just me saying, if you're Conor and you have your eyes on a third weight class title, your chances against Masvidal, given these considerations that I've mentioned, are going to be a lot better than they are against Kamaru. Kamaru is too big. He is too strong of a wrestler. He is too wrestling-centric in his approach to his offense for that to be something that I would even consider realistic. Plus, Kamaru doesn't offer the popularity boost that Jorge does. Dude, Jorge is, I mean, in every way at that point, if he wins the title, even if he doesn't win the title, quite honestly, but if he wins the title, is there a more perfect opponent for Conor than him? I mean, you want to talk about a record-setting pay-per-view that literally would have historic implications. Could, honestly, Cobb, could Jorge Masvidal as a welterweight champ versus Conor for the welterweight strap, does that best 2 million buys?
Oh, I think so.
Right. How do you say no to that? Plus, you know, Khabib's dad is obviously passed away. Who the hell knows what's next for him? Is he going to compete on time? What happens if Justin wins? Okay, you might want to go and take on Justin at that point. That might interest you. But, you know, this idea that, like, you know, the Nurmagomedov rematch is just going to be lined up and ready to go. I mean, there's a lot of complicating factors that could get in the way of that. I know he wants that one back. I'm just saying. Now, yes, folks are also asking about Nate Diaz. What about if Jorge Masvidal wins? Will they do the Nate Diaz fight again? I mean, maybe. But to me, the rematch makes more sense if Jorge loses versus if he wins. I'm telling you, if he wins, I feel bad for Gilbert, because to me, Gilbert's your number one contender in that division by a country mile at this point. More than Leon Edwards, who I know missed his opportunity that essentially Gilbert was able to take advantage of. I understand. Dude, how do you not make Jorge Masvidal versus Conor if you're a promoter at that point? And if Jorge Masvidal calls him out and says, this is the one to make, how do you resist that? 2 million buys for a historic opportunity for your most popular fighter ever? And it'd be striking friendly, and you'd have two dynamic personalities, and it could be reasonably competitive depending on one's perspective. I mean, you want to talk about promotion 101. It's the easiest sell on the face of the planet. Oh, we'd lose so much money on the gate. Do you know how much money you would make on pay-per-view? Fuck the gate. You would absolutely slay for something like that. So I don't know what's next if Jorge wins, but if they don't make the McGregor fight And I get it. He's got one win at welterweight. Well, he's got the Diaz one from a long time ago. But, you know, in terms of modern wins, he's only got the one against Cerrone from January. It's not like he's the number one contender. I'm not saying it's fair. I'm just saying all the other reasons that I've mentioned make it the easiest no-brainer call on the face of the planet. I would be shocked if they skipped it. Unless Connor just doesn't want it, which maybe he doesn't, but that would be surprising to me because you're never going to get a better opportunity to make a boatload of cash and make history against a guy who is about as perfect an opponent as there's going to be. Simple. Next.
Message.
All right, we'll wrap up our 251 questions with this one from Adrian from California, who says, "Hey, Luke, I know the UFC has three title fights, but I cannot wait to see Rose back. The first fight against Jessica was a complete pleasure to watch her footwork, head movement, and there probably won't be much change to their game plans from that first fight. I'm just excited to see Rose back and make her way back to the title. What is your interest in this matchup?"
Hi. I didn't know that I would feel that way necessarily, but now that it's all back and in motion, I feel pretty good about it. I really, I'm excited to see because, again, I was talking about this with a friend. Is Rose the best women's strawweight? I know she's not the champ, but is she the best women's strawweight? I'm not sure, but because I'm not sure, I want to see. In other words, she beat Jędrzejczyk twice. Then she was beating the brakes off Andrade before that slam. So we'll see. Let's assume she can get past it. She's going to get a title shot. And can she beat Zhang Weili? I don't know. But she has the skills to do it. And so there's this question of, like, is she the actual still reigning best women's strawweight fighter? And plus, as I mentioned, you know, a Weili Zhang and a Rose Namajunas fight, man, I'm telling you, that's huge for that division. I suspect huge for China. And It's proof of how deep that division is on the women's side of the game. And yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of reasons to like this. If, you know, she had done okay and then gotten slammed, it'd be one thing. But she was housing Jessica Andrade. It was not close. And that was a 5-round fight. This is a 3-round fight. So, you know, and with Trevor Whitman in her corner, it's like, dude, there's going to be a lot that she can do here. So yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. All right. Thanks to everyone who contributed to the mailbag. You can always do that. You don't have to wait. LukeThomasShow@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening. Catch the Luke Thomas Show live and in its entirety weekdays from 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern on Sirius XM Fight Nation Channel 156. On Twitter, follow @LThomasNews and the channel @MMA on Sirius XM.